Oh my God, Dan, we have a theme song.
So I've heard this. Welcome, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to get another welcome after the theme song. But we are the DP Sportscast. I am Dan McDonald, at Dan the Max, M-A-C-S on Twitter.
And I'm Paul Almeida, at PaulAlmeida22. We were going to come to you today with our World Cup, a Palooza spectacular-aganza, but we have a special treat today. Harrison Mooney is going to be joining us after we debut our theme song. This is exciting.
It is very exciting.
we have low standards.
We do. So Harrison will be on. We're going to talk with Harrison about all things NHL, Canucks, TV habits, movie watching habits. Then we'll segue into a bit of chat about the NBA, the French Open, and the MLB.
Are you ready for this theme song?
I am so hyped. I'm shaking in my seat. By the way, credit for this theme song goes to another McDonald. That would be my brother, Cameron
Ronald
McDonald.
No.
That would be my brother, Cameron McDonald. And follow him on Twitter. He's at Caffeine55, at K-A. Well, hey, you know, he does this kind of stuff for a living. He's a musician. So follow him at K-A-F-F-E-I-N-E-5-5.
There you go. Here it is.
All right, and welcome to a 10th. Paul, we made it to 10.
Oh, we're double digits.
We made it to a decade of podcasts.
Yes. And we still don't have a name, though.
No, we still don't have a name. Today, we're kind of riffing on two ideas for today's podcast name. We're either going to go with the Pass It to Halavich cast or the Martin Brochu cast. I'm not really sure which one you'd prefer. But we'll segue through that and into our guest. We are thrilled to have a gentleman of many colors on our show today, Harrison Mooney. Of course, he writes for the Pass It to Bulis blog on the Vancouver Sun. He's the associate editor of Puck Daddy. Do you still do the spots for Global?
Every now and then. They don't pay me, so I do them when I want to and not when they ask me to.
Seems fair. he does the occasional volunteering spot for Global
Sports.
That's
how Martin Brochu's hockey career went, too.
I go wherever they'll have me.
That's right. And he also, of course, you may have seen him to our American listeners when he was on Fox Sport Live with the Andre the Giant emulator, Jay, on right now. Harrison,
building on that success, he's come on our podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm riding a wave right now.
Yes, it's a wave of success. So Paul's mom, since you're still the only person that listens, this is kind of a big deal. Harrison, I thought we'd jump right into the important stuff. I mean, I was taking a glance at your Twitter today. There's a lot of hockey stuff going on right now. I thought that the most important question I'd ask you, though, is, who's your favorite character on Orange is the New Black?
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm totally into that right now. I just, supposed to do a lot more blogging this weekend, and instead I watched the entirety of the first season. But it's got to be Tasty. I think Tasty's the best.
Tasty is the best.
Yeah. I'm in this weird emotional awakening right now where, like, things make me cry that shouldn't. Like, I cried at the Lego movie. And it was funny, too, because, like, you know, the critic in me watches that last little bit, you know, where suddenly it gets live action and Will Ferrell shows up, and I was like, oh, this is lame. But then, like, when he has that breakthrough with his son and he finally understands, like, I was alone in the theater. It's like just like all these kids and their moms and then me, and I'm sitting there in the corner like, oh my God, family. when Tasty, when she gets out, you know, for the first time, and she's like walking to the car, and she hasn't been able to say goodbye to Poussey. And then, like, Poussey's at the window, and then she sees her, and she does a little dance. Laugh wept. It was amazing. Yeah, she's my favorite character.
Yeah, Poussey is my favorite, but those two riffing off each other are awesome. My wife and I have binge watched that, and we're actually starting season two later tonight. So I'm pretty psyched for that. I just had to get that in. Sorry, Paul, you be the professional one of us and ask him some hockey shit.
I don't want to talk hockey. I just want to talk Orange is the New Black.
Oh, man. Let's do it. I've never seen the show, so hearing someone named Poussey is interesting. I'm wondering if you guys are actually watching a show or if you're just sharing porn. But
no, it's Poussey. It's a town in France where Kings was born and shit.
Yeah.
And speaking of the Kings,
whoa,
that's a good segue.
We're gonna talk about the NBA Finals. So, no, let's talk Kings and the team that has no chance, the New York Rangers. Do they have no chance, Harrison? Are they?
I think they have a chance. Like, I feel bad for the Rangers because I mean they were so. So underrated and just kind of like unheralded coming into this. You know, a lot of people talked about the West Final as the real Stanley Cup Final, but like anybody on that plane to New York, like anyone on the Rangers flight that's like, this is over, I feel like Alain Vigneault should have just been like, let me tell you something. As the coach of one of the five teams in the last 48 years that dropped a final after losing winning the first two games, this isn't over. Like, I want him to like run into the bathroom and start crying and be like, what got into him? Like, well, he was, you know, 2011 got into him.
I don't think he was watching the Lego movie on the
But no, I mean, there's still a chance because, you know, anything could happen. And I think, too, you know, coupled with Alain Vigneault's experience as being the coach who blew a 2-0 lead, and then what the Kings did in round one against the Sharks, like, anything could happen. So it's not over yet. You know, if the Kings were to get a big injury, like, let's say they lost Drew Doughty tonight, all of a sudden the series changes completely. Like, it's not over.
Yeah.
That's fair. There's been two guys I've looked at as being difference makers, one positively, one negatively in this series. On the negative side, Henrik Lundqvist really hasn't been the Conn Smythe Trophy winner that everyone kind of thought that he was favored to be coming into this series. In game one, he was respectable. He kept them in the game in the third period. But game two, he really wasn't himself. So I would say on the negative side, he's been a little disappointing. On the positive side, Justin Williams, I think, has really reasserted himself in this series as a Conn Smythe Trophy favorite. Whereas people generally think of him only as a clutch goal scorer, I think, you know, three assists in the last game, first star honors. Would you agree that he's a guy right now who's really emerging as one of the better players on a team full of better players?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and you can tell that Justin Williams is really coming into his own because you're starting to hear my favorite phrase in hockey, which is, he's the most underrated guy in the game.
Oh, God. The Louis Erickson phrase.
Is, right? Yeah. Is that worse than he wanted it more?
maybe not. But no, I mean, you know, I think like Justin Williams is one of these guys. He's been a Corsi wizard for years. You know, he's always in the right zone, and he's a skilled guy. And I think that when you are in the offensive zone, say 60% of the time, you're going to get the bounces. And, you know, he's not a natural goal scorer, so he's not one of those guys you're going to notice. Like, if Justin Williams had the possession numbers he had and, say, Marian Gaborik's finishing ability, we'd have been talking about him a long time ago. But
yeah.
The thing is that when you have those possession numbers, eventually pucks are going to start going in. And when you get to play with Marian Gaborik and Andrei Kopitar, who right now is the best forward playing, you know, I mean, you're going to get some points.
Yeah. Justin Williams said after the game to a reporter, we're up 2-0 in the series and I don't care how we got here. I mean, should he care, though? Is giving up the first two goals twice in a row, is that water under the bridge if they win or...
Oh, hell yeah. No, I mean, the thing is, like, you can drop the first two goals and you can go down, but if you win, who cares how it happened?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons to be concerned for the Kings, I think, because they've really kind of squeaked out these two victories, and because, as you mentioned, Henrik Lundqvist hasn't been that just kind of game breaker that we all know he can be. But at the same time, you've got a 2-0 lead heading to New York for game three. I mean, what more could you ask for? It doesn't matter how you got here, but you've got it.
Yeah, kind of building on that, your buddy at Puck Daddy, Mr. Wyshynski, posted an article on Sunday morning, or maybe it was late Saturday night, talking about the Kings being the, quote, unhappiest team two games from a Stanley Cup win. Paul and I have discussed this, you know, over the past couple weeks. I am not a big fan of how Daryl Sutter handles press conferences. I mean, he makes Greg Popovich look like the Wizard of Oz. He is the most dull, trite, poorly spoken guy. And I know that people are talking about it being must-watch TV now, almost obviously in an ironic way. Do you think there's something that Daryl Sutter has I don't know if the word is hyped up his team in the dressing room as perpetually being underdogs and perpetually being a team that is underperforming. I mean, do you think that a lot of this has to do with the way Sutter acts, a lot of the what he instills in this team?
Not really. You know, I have this theory on Daryl Sutter, and it's that he really doesn't do all that much. Like, I think when Daryl Sutter arrived, he put in place a really, really great system, this puck possession system. And you watch how the Kings cycle the puck in the offensive zone. They're just there a lot. And they do a really great job of getting the puck back when they don't have it and then taking it inside the opposition blue line and just staying there. So, I mean, Sutter did this. But now that that system is in place and it's going, he basically just sets his lines and then he just kind of lets them go. He doesn't do a whole lot of line matching. You know, there isn't, you know, when another line comes over the boards that teams should be worried about, he isn't like, oh crap, get our guys off and get our checking line on. Like, that never happens with Daryl Sutter. And I do think that in a lot of ways, he's kind of like phoning it in. And I think
yeah.
that, And I think that, I mean, that's fine. You can do that when you have the team that he has and you've matched them with the right system. I'm not trying to disparage Daryl Sutter as a coach, because this is a perfect system for this team and he's got them working like a finely oiled machine. But I do think that that kind of mailing it in aspect also translates to how he handles his press conferences. If he were losing, people would hate the way he does this. In the same way that people hate John Tortorella when he's losing, you know, but when he's winning, it's like, oh man, all he cares about is winning. He doesn't want to deal with this media dog and pony show. And so I do think that what we see from Daryl Sutter right now is exceptionally annoying and only endearing because his team happens to be pretty good.
Up 2-0 in a series where they have never led at any point in a game. what makes LA such a good playoff team compared to the regular season where they look inferior to other California teams or Chicago?
In a lot of ways, I think it's luck, and not so much good luck now, but bad luck during the regular season. You know, people, like, I forget who said it, but somebody was like, oh, the Kings were that team that didn't pay attention in class and then aced the test. Yeah, sure, whatever. But I think what actually happened is during the regular season, they just didn't get those bounces. You know, a lot of times they would outpossess the crap out of a team and then they would still lose the game 2-1, you know, and that's going to happen. But the reality is, you know, you look at their underlying numbers, you look at what they bring to the table and how deep they are as a team, just the way that roster is constructed, and who cares what the standings say at the end? You know that you don't want to face the LA Kings. And I think a lot of people looked at that first series between the Kings and the Sharks, and they said, whoever wins this series is going to go on to win the Stanley Cup. And that just made so much sense because, you know, these two teams were so good. And I think we're seeing it now with the Kings. I mean, whatever about where they finished in the standings, they've always been this good.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that the Canucks were 2 points back from them in December.
Oh, it's crazy.
it's night and day. Speaking of the Canucks, before we transition over to them, do you have a prognostication for this series? I mean, do you see Kings taking it in 4 or 5, or do you see it going longer, or the Rangers even coming back?
I think the Rangers could push it to 6. Okay. If they lose tonight, I mean, this thing is over. There's no, you know, it would be an amazing narrative if the Kings were to drop a series after going up 3-0, yeah. Like, especially after how they got here. But that's not going to happen. You know, I think that if the Rangers don't win this game, it ends in 4 or 5. But if they do win game 3, I could see them pushing it to 6. No further, though.
Okay. Fair enough.
Cool.
Yeah. So we want, when you, well, since we've had you on in a time where there's, I guess, a fair amount of Canucks news and hearsay and information flying around left, right, and center, and pictures of Trevor Linden hosting scouting meetings in the grand ballroom for Queen Elizabeth and up in Whistler, we wanted to talk to you about what you think the Canucks are looking to do heading into the draft. And I mean, I was looking at the Pass It to Bulis blog, and you were talking about, I can't remember if it was you or Daniel Wagner, who was talking about the idea of trading up to get Sam Reinhart. And I know that this is an idea that's picking up some steam, certainly on the internet, in you know, in Twitter feeds and message boards that I peruse once in a while. People think that although Reinhart may not be the best pick in the draft, he's the guy that you know, the Aquilinis and or Linden and or Benning would go for. Do you think that the Canucks are seriously trying to pursue this, or do you think this is kind of more pie in the sky speculation?
it's tough to say. Like, it's funny, this off season for the Canucks has been in a lot of ways just about kissing up to the fans. You know, basically with 2 weeks to go in the season, they just kind of burned this year's team. You know, they scrubbed the website of anything that might indicate they even had a 2013-14 team.
So true.
You know, all of a sudden it was like Trevor Linden and Pat Quinn and interviews with like Sergio Momesso and stuff. So, you know, and we've seen it ever since, you know, in terms of things like, you know, they hired Trevor Linden, who everybody wants. They get the spike in season ticket renewals that they wanted. And then they don't announce the Jim Benning hiring until after they've announced it at two town hall meetings for the season ticket holders. In a lot of ways, they went out of their way to let, you know, the fans know that they're a lot more important to them than anything else. And that's fine. It's a smart business decision, but I can see why they would want to be pursuing Sam Reinhart then, because one of the big criticisms of the Canucks is they ignore the guys in their own backyard. Yeah. You know, and I mean, you see it anytime Brendan Gallagher scores a goal. It's like, well, he was in Vancouver and nobody even cared.
just a big cry fest.
Yeah, no, it's like anytime a Vancouver guy scores, people get all uptight about it. So I think that talking about Sam Reinhart makes a lot of sense right now. It's going to, you know, get the fan base excited. Whether or not they trade up for him, I mean, that remains to be seen. I think that with the way that this draft is, with, you know, you'll hear people say there are 3 to 5 guys that could go number one. I've heard people say that there are 7 to 10 guys that could turn out to be the best player in this draft. I don't know that you really need to, but I think that if the Canucks can figure out a way to get out from under one of those big defenseman contracts and move up in the draft, then they'll probably look at that. You know, I've heard people talk about Jason Garrison going back to Florida as maybe a way to kind of grease a possible trade to move up and take that pick from the Panthers. And if they can do something like that, then it's win-win. But I don't see them moving a lot of assets or moving, say, Bo Horvat, who, by all accounts, Jim Benning really likes, in order to move up in the draft.
No. I agree wholeheartedly. Do you think Florida will pick at number one, and if so, who do they take?
That's tough. You know, I actually think that they're serious about moving this pick. You know, every year the guy who gets the first overall pick starts talking about moving it, and it's really just to see if he can, you know, find some team that will turn over their pot of gold, right? I do think that the Panthers are serious about it. I think they know what they need, and right now what they need more than one guy who's going to be a good player, say, in 5 years, is a bunch of guys who are going to be good players for them for the next 5 years. You know, they've been drafting for a while, and one of the things in Florida is, you know, they made the playoffs a couple of years ago, and then they took this massive step back, and if they want to keep people interested, and they're really struggling to do it out there right now, they need a team that's going to start winning right now. And so I don't know that they can just sit tight and take that pick and wait for him to develop. Because by the time he gets, you know, he gets ready, NHL ready, and he can contribute and be a core player for them, I mean, they're in Seattle. So, you know, the Panthers need guys now. They need veteran guys, and they need a good team that their core players can build around right now.
Especially if they look at a guy like Ekblad at one. I mean, they took Gudbranson at 3 back in 2010, and he's, you know, a number 5 or 6 defenseman, it looks like.
Yeah, it's tricky with defensemen, too. Like, if you take a defenseman, you know that he's probably going to take, you know, unless he's like Drew Doughty or Alex Petrangelo, who just kind of arrived ready, he's probably going to take, you know, about 4 or 5 years before he's really there. Like, look at a guy like Victor Hedman, who I think next year is going to be the year where people realize Hedman is a top 10 defenseman in the NHL. I think he was kind of on the cusp this year.
Yeah, he was.
And, you know, that's something that a lot of Lightning fans have kind of forgotten. You know, people will look at you know, who they had in that draft, you know, either like Tavares or Hedman, and people will say, oh, well, Tavares is obviously the better player, and he has been for the last however many years. But the thing is, I think next year Hedman's up there, and it just takes time with defensemen, and I don't know that the Panthers have that kind of time.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, heading into this offseason, I mean, you look, we got a relatively weak free agent crop. I mean, let's be real, and people were talking about Thomas Vanek being a 1A type acquisition, but the playoffs he had, I mean, you know, the people in Montreal are lining up to drive into the airport. Do you see anyone in this free agent crop, you know, as being kind of a difference maker for a team that really needs it? I mean, I'm trying to think of, I mean, Vancouver is a good example of a team that could really greatly benefit from a top six winger acquisition without expending assets. And I mean, you look at this crop of free agents right now with guys like Vanek and Stastny and Camilleri, and I guess Marian Gaborik, although it looks like he's going to stay in LA. I don't know if I necessarily see any sort of game breakers in that crop. Do you?
Well, there really isn't like a massive game breaker, but the closest thing, and I think he's a lot closer than people think, is Thomas Vanek. You know, I mean, he had that run with Montreal where he didn't look all that great, but he does have a point in that, you know, if you're moving him around from line to line and he's playing with someone who has no chemistry, who he has no chemistry with, there's a pretty good chance that he's not going to be the player you want him to be. The reality is, if you sign Thomas Vanek for a few years and you find somebody he clicks with, he'll look like Thomas Vanek. Like, I don't understand. All of a sudden, people are looking at this little run that he had in Montreal, and, you know, they're being, can I say dumb assholes on your podcast?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go for it. We got the E for explicit on iTunes, man, so you can say whatever you want.
The hockey world, in regards to Thomas Vanek, is full of dumb assholes. Let's not talk about what happened in Montreal. Let's take a look at his numbers when he was in Buffalo, or even what he started to do towards the end of his tenure with the Islanders before he was moved to Montreal. He's a very good hockey player.
Yeah.
And I don't really
game player.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty tough to find. And he's probably going to come cheaper than he would if he had been as good as he can be with Montreal. So I think we're going to see a lot of people bidding on him, and they're going to underbid, and then eventually they're going to realize, oh, people are serious about getting this guy, and he's going to wind up probably getting around $6 million a year. But whoever gets him is probably going to be pretty happy about it for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Where does Ryan Kesler go?
Oh, God, that's so tricky. I do think he moves. You know, I've been going back and forth about this, and I think that the Canucks are in a pretty good position with him because he wants out. And right now, like, this is the time to trade him because in a year or two, he's going to look like Mike Richards. You know, move Kesler now. But as far as where he goes, the dark horse, as far as I'm concerned, is the Washington Capitals. I think that... you know, that team right now is built around Alex Ovechkin and then, you know, Nicklas Backstrom, who is a very skilled player, but not really the sort of guy who makes a mark. And I think that if you can get somebody like Kesler in there who can be that kind of top six center, who can play that two-way game, who can kind of lead the more defensive side of the game, which is something the Capitals don't have, and just kind of rejigger that whole identity over there, then suddenly the Capitals look like a real team. And so I do think they're the team to keep an eye out, and it helps that they're in the East. You know, and the Canucks aren't going to have to face Kesler like 11 billion times during the season.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I'd say is you'll get a big push from Pittsburgh, a massive push, because they need to get over that Boston hump, and they're not going to be able to do it without Kesler. And then I think you're going to get a huge push from Anaheim. I think the Ducks are desperate. And the fact that, you know, Kessler's in the division, and he'll be staying in the division if he goes to Anaheim, is going to make them have to pay a whole lot more. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the Canucks next year aren't going to be Stanley Cup contenders. And again, 2 years from now, Kessler's Mike Richards. So I think if you're smart, you think a little bit longer term, and you try to squeeze as many assets as you can out of Anaheim, and just kind of deal with the fact that they're going to be better than you as a result for the next year or two.
Yeah,
it's interesting you bring up Washington, because Jim Matheson was tweeting, the guy for the Edmonton Journal was tweeting about how Mike Green is available. So that would be an interesting
trade
of two disgruntled guys. No, I know I'm not a Green fan, but I mean it would be an interesting storyline.
Well, it'd be you know, that might be the fastest that I call for a GM's firing if he gets Mike Green.
That's fair enough. Last question for me. And it's probably the most loaded one for Canucks fans right now. Jason Botchford, when I was listening to him on the Team 1040, was mentioning that the two front runners right now for the Canucks head coach position are John Stevens, as expected, and Willie Desjardins, both of whom are, of course, still in action right now. Do you see these two guys as the two most viable candidates, or do you see there being a realistic fit with a guy like Dan Bylsma, who's now available, or perhaps a more off-the-board candidate like, God forbid, Mark Crawford? I heard his name mentioned the other day.
We may as well
bring in Mike Keenan and Tom Rennie as assistant coaches.
Yeah, but, just a word on the Mark Crawford thing. Whenever these names that, you know, are somehow connected to this city and have been away for a while come back, you have to ask yourself, who's calling in the favor here? Because, you know, I mean, Mark Crawford's got some buddies back here. Obviously, he would like to get back into the NHL. And so it makes a lot of sense that he'd call up somebody he knows or, you know, really start to kind of plant that. But, I mean, he's not a realistic candidate. Come on. The Canucks are all about trying. You know, they've been taking a torch to the old team. I don't think right now that reaching into their past and finding a coach who's had nothing but not success since he left here is the right option. I do think it comes down to Willie Desjardins and John Stevens. I think Bylsma is someone that they'll look at, but Bylsma's probably going to take, you know, another 5-year deal. You're going to have to outbid the Florida Panthers, who, as we've established, are desperate. I really don't think it's worth it for the Canucks to sink their teeth into a guy and be like, yes, he's going to have the same kind of run that Alain Vigneault had. Because right now they're in that kind of funny stage where they're retooling or rebuilding or whatever they want to say. And there's a pretty good chance they'll go through, you know, 3 coaches in the next 4 years. So I think that you go grab a guy like Desjardins who's getting a start and will be really happy to take an NHL job and won't demand 5 years, or a guy like John Stevens that wants to come back to coaching after he did it in Philadelphia and, again, might be willing to take a 3-year deal.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. That seems like the most realistic idea, too. And Desjardins, I mean, he looks like a good coach after what he did with the World Juniors and stuff and what he's doing with the Stars farm affiliate right now.
Yeah.
My last question before we go to the buzzer beater at the end. How disappointed are you that Pierre Maguire didn't get hired in Pittsburgh?
I'm so disappointed. Like, okay, see, we've all laughed about it because, I mean, it would have been hilarious. You know, but the thing is that I think that he would have done a good job, you know? And I think that he would have been, imagine having a resource like Pierre Maguire in a GM office, you know, where you can call him up and be like, Pierre, you know, what's going on with this? And he's going to give you the greatest quote of all time. You know, he's going to reference like 6 guys, junior teams,
their high school principal.
Yeah. You know, he knows so much. And the thing is, like, you know, you get a lot of these other guys who, when they're unemployed, they go into media and they kind of, you know, pay some lip service and do the talking head thing, you know, and then they go back to coaching and all of a sudden they have nothing to say to the media anymore. And I just kind of felt like Pierre Maguire would have not been that. You know, he would have been a guy that would not be able to shut down. Even during the interview process, the stuff that he shared with people was absurd compared to what we normally hear from people during an interview process. So yeah. I'm bummed out for him. And also, you know, hearing him talk about how, you know, I think this is the end of the line for me. Like, I'm going to focus on media now. That really, to me, sounded like a guy who's giving up on his dream, you know? Like,
So sad.
Yeah. You know, almost like when you hear, like, someone will talk about his ex-girlfriend and be like, you know, I'm really happy that she found someone. And you're like, no, you're not. Like, that's kind of what Pierre Maguire sounds like.
Paul, that sucks, doesn't it?
Oh, man, it's the worst.
About that, doesn't it? Sorry, that's an insider right there.
Clearly.
All right, well, yeah. Well, Harrison, we really appreciate your insight, man. It was awesome having you on. If you're cool with it, we're going to bring you back for the world-famous buzzer beater segment, which we do at the end, 5 questions each, if you're cool with that.
Let's do it.
All right, man, sounds good. All right, Paul, well, we're here without Harrison, which makes me a little sad because now it's just us dwindling, non-paid.
Because you've been watching the Lego movie.
That's true. which is just, I mean, it makes terms of endearment look like a comedy. Paul, what happened last night? I mean, Mr. Cramps a lot. He came back. He had a hell of a game. What do you have, 35 points or something like that? I believe
35,
LeBron had.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? You think that was the big turnaround? It was a statement game for LeBron. You think that's the turnaround in the series?
Yeah, he came back as expected. Everyone expected him to come back strong. Scored 35 and got 10 rebounds. He scored 33 of his 35 points in the last 3 quarters, so he started a bit slow. Maybe still had residual cramps. Is that a thing?
yeah, it might be a chronic condition.
He did a yoga class at 8 a.m. Maybe he was still tired. But he scored 33 of his 35 in the last 3 quarters, really turned it on. It's just like last year right now. Spurs won game 1, Heat won game 2. You know, the Heat haven't been down 2-0 in a series since LeBron Wade Bosch era started. So you can't discount the Heat. I don't know why they were such underdogs. Michael Shearer said they were going to win game 2 last time. He won me some money, actually. And so it'll be interesting now that the series goes back to Miami, now that the Spurs have lost a game at home. The question I have for you, Chris Bosh had the clutch three at the end of the game there.
Yeah.
Is Chris Bosh one of your top five of big men in the league?
I don't, you know, it's so hard to say because look, Chris Bosh was on the Raptors. I think there's no denying that he was a top five, maybe top three big man in the entire league. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm some sort of, you know, basketball whiz at all because shit, I'm really not. But when I look at at top big men, which is what, yeah, I'd consider a guy who plays power forward or center. I look at Kevin Love. I look at Dwight Howard. I look at LaMarcus Aldridge. And then there's, I mean, and then you gotta look at Duncan, of course, because Duncan, I think you still have to classify as a big
number
man.
One, yeah.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you would classify Blake Griffin as a big man because he's more versatile. I would say no, you don't classify him as a big man. And if you don't, then I think you can start to slide Bosch into that conversation alongside maybe a guy like Al Jefferson from Charlotte or Joakim Noah, the man, yeah, you know, with the best hair in the league.
The thing is that it used to be a very easy structure of you have your one, your point guard, two, your shooting guard, three, your small forward, four, your power forward, and five is your center and your big man. Now mm-hmm. it's turned into this game where LeBron, a 6'10" guy, brings the ball up the floor. And you got Kevin Durant shooting from the outside. So you, I guess, big man in the classic sense was the center, the you know, Hakeem Olajuwon, Shaquille O'Neal role. But yeah. Now I guess big man, if you classify Durant as a big man, LeBron as a big man, there's your one and two. But so yeah, I guess so. But yeah, I think the Spurs will still win this in seven, unfortunately.
Okay. And just for frame of reference, because we should bring it back to this considering the content of our podcast, the Spurs to win in seven, like we were talking about, which I think I said Spurs in six. You said Spurs in seven. Spurs are now the underdog to win the series. The Heat are favored at 1.68.
What?
And the Spurs are at 2.25 on Bet365. I know it's changed since we last looked at it.
That's
because
crazy.
One win. It is. Series correct score. Paul told you at the start, Spurs to win in seven is actually down in odds to 3.75, so that's more favored. Spurs to win in six is now at 6-1. Heat to win in five is at 6-1. And interesting, Heat to win in six is now at 3.6-1,
wow,
which is better than their odds to win at seven. So they're kind of all over the place at Bet365 with this right now. I don't really think they know what they want.
No, so get in there and make a bet. Just make a... Let's see, finals MVP. Is there anyone besides LeBron James, 1.71, Tony Parker at 4, Duncan at 4, Ginobili at 11, and then Wade and Bosch 17. Then after that, it's just 67-1. It's pretty much the big three from each.
Get your Boris Diaw bets in, as Michael Shearer said. Paul, French Open ended this past weekend. We talked about it a lot because your girl was in there. She made it all the way to semifinals. Hashtag Eugenie Love. Jeannie's army, indeed. The winners in the end, though, were Maria Sharapova and Rafa Nadal. Nadal, really, he looked like a much better player than Djokovic at the end of that game. So my match, pardon me, just use the right vernacular. So my question for you then, is Rafa the best ever?
No, not yet. I think he might get there. He's, what, 26, and he has 14 Grand Slams. For reference, Federer has 17. Out of the big four, Djokovic has 6, Murray has 2. So Nadal is creeping up there. It's a statistical comparison. Federer has 17 Grand Slams, Nadal has 14. 9 of those have been in the French Open, so maybe he's not as well-rounded as Federer, but he's 3 behind. Once he gets up to 16, then we can start talking. He will get there eventually, I think, because of Federer's decline. Djokovic will get up there too. The match between Djokovic and Nadal, it started off well. Djokovic surprised Nadal with 6-3 first set win. Nadal came storming back, taking the second set 7-5. And then it kind of got a little boring, I think, the match. Nadal looked kind of unstoppable and took it to another level through the third and handled what looked like a sick Djokovic easily, 6-2. I don't mean sick as in, like, sick. I mean he was throwing up, and they showed a disgusting slow-mo of him spitting. Thanks, NBC. But Nadal, he was in the fourth set. He was up a break. He looked well on his way to a title. Djokovic found a way to break. Tied the fourth set at 4. Looked like momentum was swinging, just like he did last year. But Nadal quickly snuffed that out and broke Djokovic. And Won his ninth French Open title, which is unreal. Who is the better player to win every major except the French Open? Is it Djokovic or Pete Sampras?
Well, I mean, didn't Pete Sampras hold the record before my boy Fed passed him? So I'd have to say Sampras. I wasn't old enough really to watch tennis seriously enough to know what Sampras is dealing with. But that stuns me that he has so many wins from Australia, Flushing Meadows and Wimbledon, and he has none from. He must have just been terrible on clay.
Maybe you just ran into a nemesis who was good on clay. I can't think back that far too. Just like Djokovic, poor guy.
Yeah, I know people at all times. Paul, give the people in men and women right now. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a group of five for the men and a group of five for the women. Give the people a favorite heading into Wimbledon. The top five on Bet365 for the men right now: Djokovic, 2.75. Murray, 4. Nadal, 5. Federer, 5. Wawrinka at 11.
I don't know why they put Murray up there. They put Murray up there because he won. He was riding
home court.
He was riding the home court advantage and the momentum, which was astonishing. I don't think he should have won that tournament. He was not the best player in any of his matches, but he just rode the emotional wave all the way there. I don't think you put Murray even close. Play this back for me in a month when I'm wrong, but. Djokovic versus Nadal, I think, is inevitable. Maybe inevitable again. Federer does thrive at Wimbledon, though, so he might be your kind of long shot at 5-1. I'll give it to Djokovic right now and take the easy way out.
Okay.
For the women,
The women top five, we got Serena at 2.1, Azarenka at 3.5, Sharapova at 8, Li Na at 11, and our girl Eugenie coming fifth at 17.
Really?
Yep.
To win Wimbledon outright?
Yeah. Tied with Halep at fifth to win Wimbledon outright.
Oh, I have different odds here then.
Oh.
Are you on Bet365, Wimbledon women?
I might be. I'm looking at the U.S. Open. Ignore me, folks. I'm a dumbass. to win Wimbledon outright for women. Serena's at 2.2.
There we go.
Maria's at 6. Azarenka at 9. Petra Kvitova at 12. Lina at 13. Eugenie's at 15.
Yeah. There we go. Bouchard's still a great pick because she's going to get better in this next month. I don't know if she'll win. I'll give that. They have up the odds on the Sharapova I've seen. At 6-1. And the way Sharapova's playing, I'll take Sharapova right now. Sharapova, I don't think Serena will win. I'll take Sharapova or Azarenka.
Okay, seems fair.
And then Major League Baseball, you wanted to talk about the four top teams you feel right now in the MLB. Who are they and why?
All right, my favorite part of every segment, if I'm being honest. Look, the four best teams in the league right now, when we were entering this season, Paul and I didn't have the luxury of doing podcasts entering the season where I was able to talk to people about my predictions going into the season. But for the website I write for, I gave one team that I thought was going to be a real surprising team, and that was the San Francisco Giants. And lo and behold, they're the best team in the league right now at 42-21. Look, this is a team that has a kid who this year is developing into, you know, if not the best, then one of the top three pitchers in the league in Madison Bumgarner. He has the best name in the league already. Now he's quickly becoming one of the best pitchers in the league. They got Morse hitting home runs for them left, right, and center. They got a guy like Angel Pagan who's hitting great for them. Their pitching rotation is solid. You know, they're 9.5 games up on the Dodgers, who I had as World Series favorites at the start of the year. I really, really like these Giants right now. I mean, this is a team that, you know, they had a shitty year last year, no doubt. Thanks to injuries, they were a sub-500 team. But let's not forget, folks, that this team won the World Series the year before that with, you know, largely the same roster. So right now on Bet365, they are tied for third in odds at 9 to win the World Series. That's a decent bet. This is a team that is clicking on all cylinders. The other team is also a Bay Area team, the Oakland Athletics, who right now, Paul, I don't know if you Okay. Sorry, I do know. You know,
they won 11-1 yesterday. I knew that.
They sure did. Their run differential is +128 on the season. They have the most runs scored and the fewest runs against. And they have the fewest runs against, you know, by a healthy margin over every team except for Atlanta. So they are a dirty, dirty team. And really, the only reason they're 39-24 and not like 50-11 is because they, you know, they've blown out a lot of teams. So that's kind of made that that numerical discrepancy a little bit inflated. But, you know, their pitching has been hit and miss. I mean, like, they got Sonny Gray, who's in his second year, and he looks like a hell of a young pitcher. But I look at Scott Kazmir, and here's a guy who was an all-star back in the day with the Tampa Bay Rays. I mean, people remember Scott Kazmir. He's got a dope name, and he was a hell of a pitcher. But I think he got Tommy John in like 2009, and he was really derailed. I mean, he became a pitcher who went all the way down to Double A and who couldn't do anything. And now he's back up, pitching in a starting role for the best team in the AL. He's 7-2. He's got a 2.2 ERA. And right now he looks like an all-star. So yet again, Billy Beane's team is Billy Beane himself is proving to be a genius at acquiring these guys who are on, you know, a downturn in their career who still have something left in the tank. Kazmir is a great example. Now, naturally with the Athletics, this is a team that we need to see what they do come the playoffs, because we've had this song and dance with them before, where they've had an excellent regular season. They get to the playoffs, and then for whatever reason, you know, their guys who they rely on this year, it's Cespedes and Brandon Moss and Coco Crisp, but these guys drop off. Do I think they're going to drop off this year? No, because you got Donaldson, who's a young guy who's having a hell of a year as well. They have a lot of depth, but there's always that risk with the Athletics.
Yeah, that AL West.
Not AL West.
My Mariners are currently winning 3-0. That's all I know about the AL West.
You know, Seattle will be a good team eventually. I mean, you know, they're 5.5 back of the Athletics, so they're not having a terrible. 33-29 is very respectable. In the wild card right now, they're holding the second wild card spot.
Yeah.
They're a game and a half up on the Orioles and either the Yankees or Cleveland or the Royals or something like that. But they are holding down a wild card spot right now. Their big problem is that they need to have consistent pitching behind Felix.
Yeah. They're wasting, you know, his 15 strikeout performances.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. So when you lose, when he puts up 12, 13 strikeout nights, you got a serious problem, because he is one of the best pitchers of this era. And I mean, I read an article on ESPN that was talking about how Felix Hernandez is a guy who could reach the end of his career never having played in a single playoff game, which is just absurd because of how good he is. Yeah. But right. I mean, they got Elias and they got Chris Young, so they have the potential to have a good couple pitchers behind him, but it's probably not good enough to do any sort of damage.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, let's bring Harrison back in for our world famous buzzer beater.
And here it comes.
Here we go. Harrison, you can come back. Stop. We won't show the Lego movie anymore. Come back.
He's probably binge watching more Orange is the New Black right now.
During that whole time.
I'm eating a banana, actually.
Oh.
Okay.
Bananas and bagels. He's only eating food that starts with the letter B today.
That's right. Later I'll have a banana bagel and then the world will end.
And then he'll have some beer.
Oh, that's the best part.
Banana bread beer, which is actually weirdly good.
Is that a thing?
You can get it, like, yeah, it's good.
Where do you live?
Vancouver.
Well, I'm going to need to find it when I get back there. All right, this is our world-famous buzzer beater segment. It's known in three cities across the world, and that counts. Four cities across the world, and that counts as worldwide.
What's the fourth city? We got Edinburgh, we got Calgary, and we got Vancouver.
Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, man, that's right. Our basketball insider. That's right. Okay. Two continents, baby.
Yes, we're making our way. Dan and I usually ask each other 10 questions, but we have a guest, so we will pool our resources and ask 5 each. Harrison, your punishment, should you get one subjective question wrong or don't do this in an adequate amount of time, you have to spell Darren Detition's last name live for us right now.
Awesome.
Here we go. I will lead it off. Number one. Here we go, Harrison. Who's taller, Jay Onwright or Yao Ming?
Well, I mean, it's Yao Ming, but it's weirdly close.
Who's your Conn Smythe favorite right now?
Probably Justin Williams. I think Conn Smythe is usually based on the narrative, and right now the whole Mr. Game 7 thing that he's got going for him is probably enough for him to get the votes.
Don Cherry said on Coach's Corner that Jonathan Toews is Chicago's best player. I certainly agree. Do you?
I do. I don't think that he's their most skilled player. I think that goes to Patrick Kane. But in terms of overall best, yeah, it's John Toews.
Harrison, name me one player who isn't a Vancouver Canuck right now, be it a prospect, an upcoming draft pick, a free agent, a trade acquisition, whatever, who will be on the Canucks roster come opening day in October.
Oh, good Lord. I have no idea. Now I have to... Marcel Gotch.
Marcel Gotch. Okay, interesting. Fourth line center. I like that.
This is a multiple choice question. Why is the two-goal lead the worst lead in hockey? Is it complacency by the winning team, momentum from the losing team? Is it black magic, or is it D, it's not my fault, I'll just blame it on my goalie?
Well, I'll say C, but if I can add an E, it's because it's more noticeable when you lose a two-goal lead than when you lose a one-goal lead.
That's so true. The logical statistics analysis. Yeah, I like it. All right, in honor of your namesake, Jan Boulis, who's the best Canuck to ever wear the number 93? Was it Jan Boulis? Was it Pavel Dimitra, the late Pavel Dimitra? Or was it the underrated hug monster, Victor Oreskovich?
Ooh, you know, Victor Oreskovich was not a good hockey player.
He's a real estate agent now.
I'm going to go with Pavel Dimitra, the late, may he rest in peace.
Sidney Crosby is the best player in the NHL right now, and consequently, the best center in the NHL. Who are your number two and three centers?
Number two and three centers. Right now, I'll probably go... I'd go John Toews as my number two, yes. And then Patrice Bergeron as my number three, but it's really close with Andre Kopitar.
Ah, okay.
I would posit Beau Giroux in there, but fair enough.
Close Giroux.
Yeah, we'll have this discussion off air.
Does the discussion involve you pulling off your mask and revealing that you're Peter Laviolette, the only guy who thinks that?
Yeah. Actually, I'm Ed Snyder, frankly. This Scott, podcast is going on CSN Philly.
Scott Hartnell.
Harrison, I noticed from your Twitter that you're a bit of a tennis fan, a bit of a tennis follower. Eugenie. Just your general thoughts. Is she going to win a major at some point? I mean, she's a hell of a player, and she's a hell of a marketing tool for Nike.
Yeah, I think eventually she wins a major. It's funny right now. Like, I'll tell you why she wins a major, because I've been praying every day that she would win something so we'd stop having to hear about how she was the first Canadian to make the semifinals, or, you know, the first Canadian to be ranked number 17 in the world in September. Like, these stupid little things that we do in order to make her accomplishments meaningful, I think eventually we're gonna be able to stop doing that, because she's going to win a major, and then that'll be it. No one will be able to talk about these weird little qualifiers. It'll just be Jeannie Bouchard won a major, first Canadian to win one of the majors, blah, blah, blah.
Thank God. Number nine, FIFA World Cup or Winter Olympics?
Ooh, probably the World Cup. The Winter Olympics are more fun as a Canadian because Canada's in them. But, you know, I mean, I'm a big soccer fan. The World Cup is amazing. And as a dude who's half German and half Ghanaian, I'm very excited for Group H this year, which is just all Germany and Ghana. Is it Group G?
Group G, yeah.
My bad. But also, America's in there. And there's nothing I love more than when an African team beats America, and Twitter just goes so crazy. It's the funniest thing. It's like, we lost to Ghana!
Give us your World Cup prediction.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Brazil. I mean, come on.
All right.
It's gotta be. Group G's also got Paul's team, the Portuguese, in there, who can fall to the Ghanaians. All right, and the last question for you, Harrison. Who's the best Russian? Is it Alex Ovechkin? Is it Maria Sharapova? Or is it Red from Orange is the New Black?
It's Red from Orange is the New Black. And fellas, it's not close.
It's not. And it's not even close.
Hey, I have a bonus question for you, Harrison.
Yes.
The series shifts to New York now. If you had a chance to go see one event in New York City that isn't hockey, what would it be? Would it be the Tony Awards, the U.S. Open Tennis Major, New Year's Eve in Times Square, or a taping of Live with Kelly Ripa and Michael Strahan?
Probably the Tony Awards. I just watched that video where Neil Patrick Harris is doing Hedwig, and he dances all up on Sting and Sam Jackson.
Yeah,
that's great. I'm a big Broadway fan, so
yes. You're now allowed back on the podcast.
I heard that Bryan Cranston won something for Breaking Bad the Musical or something. That's so cool.
No, but close enough. You knew Bryan Cranston.
Fair enough. So I got to slip that in whenever I get the chance.
All right. That's it for us. Thanks, Harrison, for joining us.
Wait, hold on. Harrison. I don't have to spell Darren DeChison?
You got questions right.
Okay.
I totally can.
All right. Hit it. You have 3 seconds.
All right, so it's DutchyShen. It's Dutchy Shen. It's really easy to remember that way.
Wow. I think at the end of that, after you say that, you have to say bang.
Bow. Boom. Roasted.
Hashtag bang, Kate Burness. All right. Yeah, Harrison, it was wonderful to have you on, man. I will hope to have you on sometime in the future.
Cool. Thanks for having me, guys.
And folks, go follow him at Harrison Mooney on Twitter.
He needs our promotion.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He needs my 38 followers to go tweet at him. God, I think he's fine.
All right. See you later.
Real quick, Paul, tell the folks when we're doing the World Cup of Palooza, because, I mean, look, they tuned in tonight just for that.
Tomorrow. We're
tomorrow.
It.
Tomorrow. Don't.
I know the Tony Awards were brought up, but it's okay.
I should be letting you do the musical shit, shouldn't I?
I love how we do this whole podcast and no one knows what we actually do for a living.
No. You know, we could be mafiosa for all that. We're not, just in case, you know, the feds are listening. But we could really be doing anything.
We could. What do you do, Dan?
And with that, folks, we'll see you tomorrow night.
See ya.
Hashtag see ya.